Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Malcolm Keating. Today we'll be talking to Priyambada Sarkar, author of Language, Limits, and Beyond, Early Wittgenstein and Rabindranath Tagore, published in 2021 by Oxford University Press. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, Priyambada.
Thank you so much, Malcolm. It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm really looking forward to talking with you. Let me start by asking you my first question. What is your book's main goal, and why did you think it was important to write?
The primary aim of my book is to point out that despite innumerable differences in the intellectual makeups, in belonging to two different modernities, these two intellectual geniuses and creative geniuses, Tagore and Wittgenstein, they had some striking parallels in their thoughts about the limits of language, about the limits of the world, and the distinction between sense and nonsense, or the expressible and the inexpressible, in their writings. And my goal was to show that more sense can be made of Wittgenstein's cryptic writings, early cryptic writings on these things, where he's talking about the identity of ethics, aesthetics, and religion on the one hand, and he's talking about that some important things, you cannot represent it in ordinary terms. All these cryptic things, which have generated lots and lots of controversies, much more sense can be made of these remarks if these views are juxtaposed with the writings of Tagore regarding all these issues. So this is more or less the fundamental aim of the text. Yes. Now you might think that why is this juxtaposition important? Well, okay, the poet says so-and-so, and the philosopher says such-and-such, but they overlap in their thinking. But why is it important? It is important in a very fundamental sense. And this fundamental sense is that there are some perennial issues in philosophy about life and world, where we can see the concurrence of concerns, not philosophical agreements or disagreements, but concurrence of concerns of the poet and the philosopher. And such overlapping is important. Such overlapping is important because it points to the reader to look into this, to go deep into this bigger picture, where the meaning of life and world is connected with ethics, aesthetics, and religion. And it also gives rise to various important questions, whether the meaning of leading a good, truthful, and compassionate living, does it add a value, a purpose, a meaning to our existence in this universe? So it can, and another important thing which I want to mention here, that my reference to Tagore is not intended to mean that Wittgenstein was inspired by him, or he was following Tagore in these respects. I didn't say this. I cannot claim this because I have not seen any evidence of acknowledgement or indebtedness. So what I intend to point out is that despite their differences in their outlooks, in their ultimate goals, in their methodologies, they somehow arrived at the same conclusion. They go through literature and Wittgenstein through logic. And this fundamental thing where they in fact converged is that both of them believed that there is a limit to the expressibility of words in a language. But this portraying of the limits, that this existence of the limits is not ultimate. One can really transgress these limits, or can peep into the beyond, not in a direct manner, that is not possible, but in an indirect manner, through bending of meanings, through suggestiveness, as in a poem, in a work of art, and in music, where you can apprehend the unutterable, which you cannot utter sensibly in your ordinary language.
Mm-hmm. Right, and so you're looking at the early Wittgenstein and his Tractatus, and you're looking at Rabindranath Tagore's corpus, which of course is quite vast. So I'm curious, how did you come to be interested in the topic, in these two philosophers, thinkers, a poet and a philosopher, rather?
I was struck by the similarity. I didn't even imagine at the time, but I got carried away first by reading Raymond's book on Wittgenstein, where he narrated, I think, around 5 and 7, 8 pages, Wittgenstein and Tagore relationship. In fact, I was motivated by those writings first. And before that, when I got introduced to the philosophy of Wittgenstein in my master's class, then it struck me that he was reading poems from Gitanjali when asked to elucidate the important questions of the Tractatus in the Vienna circle. As probably you all must be knowing about it, so I'll not elaborate. But I was astounded. I was intrigued, and by this correlation. And later, when Raymond wrote in not in very many details, but at least he hinted about Wittgenstein's translation of The King of the Dark Chamber in English, along with Smythe's, in his later years. And before he gave his lectures on psychology, religion, aesthetic psychology, and religious belief in 1937, he read Raja twice along with Smythe's before he gave this lecture. But I haven't yet explored the possibility of parallels with Tagore in his later writings, where he almost discarded his earlier notion of sense and nonsense, which somehow corresponds with the sayability, saying and showing. But yet, I've noticed that he has written, he has said in some of his conversations that philosophical investigations is also like a poem, like one should treat it like a poem. But I haven't explored it yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is an interesting point that Wittgenstein will get into this, characterized the Tractatus as a work of literature. So that we'll return to that in a minute. But let's back up a little bit, because while most listeners know Wittgenstein, they may not know Rabindranath Tagore, at least the listeners of the Philosophy podcast. Can you start by saying who Tagore is, and of course, just situate him, who Wittgenstein is as well?
Oh, well, I forgot to tell you in your earlier question that one of my aims also too was to the readers, like those who are not at all familiar with the oeuvre of Tagore's writings, they can approach him through Wittgenstein. And the people who know only works of Tagore, they can also approach Wittgenstein through Tagore. And I have attempted that in my book. Now, to be specific, to talk about the philosophy of Tagore is difficult. Why? Because he was reluctant to call himself a philosopher. He was happy. He was comfortable. He was comfortable with the poet tag. He said, "I'm poet. I'm happy. I'm happy with it. And I don't want to philosophize." He said this, and no wonder his contemporaries and also commentators, they were also they did not differ. They also agreed with this. So it's really, after so many years, you hardly could find a proper philosophy abstracted from his writings. If one reads his book, mainly his letter works, carefully, he can find him to be a unique philosopher, having all the systems like ontology, epistemology, axiology, ethics, and also philosophy of language. So one will have to, he didn't say that this is something which will go to my ontology or my epistemology represents this. He did not write. But with a careful eye, you can see this, that one follows from the other, and one can build a unique system of philosophy, which is not really. Some people dismiss Tagore's philosophy by saying that here we find the philosophy of the Upanishads. And that's all. No, that is not the truth. His own uniqueness is visible in his writings. And one can, as I said, one can have his views on each of these branches, his own philosophical views about these. And I have attempted a bit in this text. And I must say that this is an unexplored mine. So let others come and do it better, quote and unquote. But this can be a huge project where one can go and reflect, and which has its uses even today in contemporary philosophy. Now, coming to the basic things, as I said, that usually people do away with his philosophy by saying that it's the philosophy of Upanishads, and also say that he was influenced by Vaishnavism or some Western commentators. They say that according to them, that it's a new form of Christianity. Now, what I want to show that these three, like he was totally immersed in the philosophy of Upanishads. This is also half truth. He was influenced by Vaishnava philosophies. That is also half truth. And Christianity, of course, he said in many of his interviews that his Lord of life comes very close to New Testament concept of God. But in spite of that, one can see his own uniqueness in his philosophy. Now, he was born as a Brahmo in a very elite cultured family, and there he was induced into Brahmo Dharma. It's a monotheistic religion developed on the philosophy of the Upanishads. He was initiated into it. In fact, he disbursed his duties as secretary of Brahmo Samaj quite vigorously. So people can think in that line, but he was later disillusioned. He felt that the authority of man, gets carved by the existence of religion, not only by the existence of religion, but also by tradition, by custom, by scripture, and also by rituals. So he didn't really want to get himself tagged to be a member of any particular religion. At that time, he was moved to some extent to Hindu Dharma when he was establishing the school at Shantiniketan. There, he wrote to the headmaster that nothing which is not written in Sanghita will be practiced in my school. So at that time, he was under the impression that this Hindu religion is not an institutionalized religion. But later he understood he had some bad experiences, and he understood, and then he distanced himself from Hindu Dharma. And then he was influenced by Vaishnava lyrics, Vaishnava lyrics, but he was not totally a Vaishnavite, because he used to believe, another important point, that he did not believe in the philosophy of Upanishads because he did not believe the world is an illusion. He believed that he is enjoying this color, taste, and the beautiful beauty of nature, of this world. So he doesn't want liberation.
Right. So he's like, let's maybe move a little bit back to Wittgenstein too, because this seems like there's some connections here that you're drawing. And I want to make sure that we're getting sort of to interweave, as you do excellently in the book, interweave Tagore with Wittgenstein. So, Tagore, yeah. So you were just saying Tagore is a poet. He's philosophically inclined, and Wittgenstein is a poetic philosopher in some ways, right? So maybe can we also move back to the Tractatus, talk about how that's important, and then we can go back to Tagore again as well.
Yes, I have not. That's true that I spent a bit of long time in elucidating this, that what he is not. But what he is, where we can find similarities, that he, in his ontology, he distinguished between fact and truth. Now, as far as his notion of fact is concerned, we understand it quite well. It's something, if S is P, then the fact will be that it, that S is P. So there is no, it goes along with the view of the Tractatus, that where fact is something which can be stated objectively, scientifically. Then he talked about truth. His notion of truth is quite it's complicated and it's controversial also. But to sum it up, his notion of truth is something which is interconnected with the whole universe. It's not a truth of a particular thing. It's actually when a scientist or an ordinary person talks about something, talks about a fact of the world, he thinks that is an abstraction. Why is it an abstraction? Because it has been truncated. We have separated it from the whole of the world to which it is also related. Like, think of physiology as a science. It's a science of human body. So it is objective, scientific, objective knowledge, because you can teach someone and someone can learn from you. But he says, this is not the whole truth. If a doctor operates on his child, he treats his child's body as simply a body, not as his son. Then Tagore would say, he is not having the whole truth. Whole truth is there. Whole truth will encompass first that he is the child is his son. So in all interrelationships, all facts are correlated, and usually we don't apprehend this. We are all happy in our cocoons, but barrier sometimes in some experience, in some mystical experience of the whole, this barrier is gone, this barrier is lifted, then you can feel that you are identical with the whole of the world. Then you feel that you are just a member of all other things of the universe, and you all are related to everything in this universe, and this is the truth. So for him, I don't know how far I could make you understand, but the thing is, ultimate truth is the truth of relationship and the truth of harmony in the universe, and this is the fundamental principle of creation. Now this distinction between fact and truth, it in his epistemology, it takes the place of science and art. Art with capital A, which includes music, dance, artists, art, sculpture, everything under with capital art. And the art apprehends truth. And science deals with facts. And he says that scientist, what does the scientist want? The scientist seeks an impersonal principle, which can be applied to all things, natural laws. In contrast with that, the artist finds out the unique, the individual, but yet it is in the heart of the universal. So artist is apprehending truth, but not the scientists. And in ethics, this distinction, he draws a distinction between sreyo and preyo, that is, what is desired and what ought to be desired. What is desired comes under fact, science, and what ought to be desired comes under this truth. And in philosophy of language, he talks about two types of language. One is factual, scientific, which can state whatever is happening in the world. And another type of language, that is the language of the poet. And the poet doesn't say everything clearly, but you understand from what he has said, what he has not said. So you get what is not said by seeing, by reading what he has said. So one can apprehend the unutterable here by those utterances. So here you can see the analogy with Wittgenstein. And there's one particular analogy which he makes while he was giving lectures in America, and those lectures were given in English. There he was saying that fact is not adequate to express truth. It's like a wine cup. It will hold only a cup full of wine, and it cannot hold the all other wine, whatever is there in the jug or in the world. And he delivered this lecture in 1922, and in 1929, Wittgenstein is saying in a lecture on ethics that he's giving the analogy like it's a teacup. A teacup can contain only a cup full of water, not a gallon of water that we cannot put on the cup. So fact is also not adequate. And here in a lecture on ethics, which Wittgenstein delivered in 1929, he distinguished between relative judgments of value and absolute judgments of value. And by this analogy, he wanted to say there are things which you cannot express, represent in ordinary language, because the capacity of the cup is to have only one cup of water, not more than that. So there are things which are beyond the cup.
So the discussion in the Tractatus that's interesting to many is the connection between aesthetics, the ethical, and the mystical. And of course, this idea that there's something that we have to pass over in silence. And there's suggestive remarks that in some sense, ethics and aesthetics are part of this. And one thing that I thought was interesting in your book that maybe you could elaborate on is the discussion of the rose as an object of aesthetic concern for Tagore. It was helpful for understanding connections between Wittgenstein and Tagore. So maybe you could explain that idea of the rose as an object of aesthetic concern in Tagore and how it helps with some of the ideas in the Tractatus, especially about the idea of the world, the totality of the world in that context.
Yes. When he talked about the rose, and Wittgenstein was talking about ethics and aesthetics being one, both of them were saying something that aesthetical viewing is a different kind of viewing. It's not normal viewing. It's viewing from eternity, viewing subspecie eternitatis. And this is also very similar in Tagore, and like there are parallels in Tagore and Wittgenstein. And exactly when you are talking about the rose, Tagore saying that, as I was explaining while distinguishing between fact and truth, science and art, that the fact is an abstraction. Fact does not give you the feeling of interrelationship of the universe. So think of a miser. Think of a miser. He knows for him, truth is money. But this money does not contribute to the harmony of people of the universe. Because he's segregating himself, who's full of money, from those who have no money. The world is divisible into haves and have-nots. But if you see the thing from an aesthetic point of view, when you see a rose, then that contributes to the harmony of the universe, to the harmony of the outer with the inner. It's not its petals, it's not its color, it's not its form. It's all together. As a whole, it comes to you, and it takes you to a different plane, where you can see that you are identical. You can identical with the whole flower. You can identical with the whole environment, with the whole sky, and it is also the same thing is true about music, and any form of art. They take you to a different plane, and from that plane, you don't see things differently, separately, separate from each other, but a unified whole. And Wittgenstein said in the Tractatus that the world the proper way of viewing is to view the world as a limited whole. And viewing the world as a limited whole, this is viewing from eternity. And this viewing from eternity helps you to see yourself to be related with other things of the universe. Then you can wonder at the existence of the world, that I wonder that the world exists.
Right, which is what Wittgenstein says is the sort of mystical attitude, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So with this attitude of this orientation towards the world, we might wonder where God fits into the world for both Wittgenstein and Tagore. You were explaining Tagore's religious views earlier when I sort of shifted our conversation a little bit. So maybe we could talk about that again and connect this up to Wittgenstein, because he too has a religious journey that he's known for from Christianity and Judaism in particular. And whereas Tagore, as you were mentioning, has this journey from Vaishnavism, various forms of Hinduism, Orthodox Hinduism, the Brahmo Samaj, etc. Where do they think God fits into this picture of the world and the self and our connection to things like roses and art objects?
Yes, they are connected in the things that both of them were against. They didn't believe in institutionalization of religion. They didn't believe in institutionalized religions. Although interpreters have talked about, have wanted to tag them as being this or as being that. But as I have explored in my book, that no tag is sufficient to to capture their journey from religiosity to spirituality. And where there is an aversion to institutionalized religion, and there is this feeling of interconnectedness with the universe, feeling of interconnectedness with the universe, and also feeling of the world, as a limited whole, and wondering at the existence of the world. These all are, it's a kind of looking into the world when you look at it from a different perspective, from a different point of view. And this point of view for both of them is viewing subspici eterni, viewing from eternity. And this viewing from eternity, that is there in their journey from religiosity to spirituality. And both of them were, Wittgenstein stated clearly that the religion of the future will be an ethical religion. So ethics is more important. If you behave well, and if you think of others, if you are compassionate towards others, then that will lead you to God.
I'm sorry. I was just going to ask, and for Wittgenstein, ethics is really also about the meaning of the world too, right? Not just principles and rules.
Yes. In the notebooks, he has written, at least quite a few remarks about the meaning of life. He was somehow, at least all those remarks make him more clear than whatever he said in the Tractatus. So meaning of life is something which is not in the world. So that is not something which is statable in words, but that is something which is the boundary of the world. And this is something which he uses this particular term in the Tractatus also as higher. So this is something which he calls higher. Now, what is this meaning of life? He again says that the meaning of life can be changed. The unhappy life, when you feel that your life has no meaning, it's so unhappy, you are unhappy. That life can be changed into a life that is happy. Then how can you make this change? Which life is a happy life? And he gives the hint: happy life is harmonious life. That is, it goes along well with the rest of the universe. And again, which life is? How can you acquire happy life? By renouncing all your amenities in the world, amenities of the world. That is also an ethical stance, that you can be happy. Like, if you will not be bothered if you do not get anything, because you have transcended over your craving. Renunciation, this concept is very important. And Wittgenstein also wanted to go to monasteries sometimes, church sometimes, but he later rejected this idea. But still, this renunciation is a very important concept, and has its effect on his life also, because his life also was very simple and ascetic. So you can have a happy life, you can have a meaningful life, only if you look at life and world from a different point of view. From viewing the world subspici eterni. Now, that is there. And in Tagore, so it is there that what is to be desired, that has to be evaluated. Whether it contributes to the good of everyone, then it will be something which one ought to desire. So this distinction is there. Like here also, I find affinities in their thinking, parallels in their thinking.
Yeah, and so here's something that strikes me about the affinities that you pointed out. While Tagore is not merely regurgitating the Upanishads. He's certainly influenced by them and takes them in creatively. And Wittgenstein says something interestingly. He says, God is how things stand, and how things stand is God.
Yes.
And so does this suggest a sort of Upanishadic approach? And if the world is the totality of facts, but how the world is contingent, it could be different ways, does that have implications for how we think about God?
Yes, yes. Very good question. Yes, if you think of God from the perspective of the world as the totality of facts, then he writes clearly that God does not reveal himself in the world. But there is this apparently pantheistic statement, like God is how things stand, and how things stand is God. It seems that one can have this view only when one can view the world as view the world from eternity. And there you can see that these two worlds, apparently it seems that the Tractatus is divided into two hubs, like one is the world as the totality of facts, where there is no value, where there is no meaning, and there is another world which is higher, which is valuable, and which is meaningful. But actually, these are not watertight compartments. These are not divided into watertight compartments. They are related. They are related in the way that one manifests the other. And once you can view the world from eternity, you can view the world as a miracle, and you can view view the world also as being contingent, as the totality of facts. But viewing from eternity, here God does not take a special kind of God, metaphysical God or philosophical God for which philosophers give arguments. No, not that kind of God. It's something which is personal yet universal. But that is something which is not stateable in ordinary language. This is onirvachaniya. That is, you cannot say it in words. So I think there are, God does not reveal himself in the world is from the contingent point of view, from the point of view of the world, and God is how things stand is world seen from the point of view of eternity.
I guess let's go back to the question of the limits of language then. Doesn't Wittgenstein seem to be saying an awful lot about the unsayable? This is one of the questions about his book, the Tractatus. It seems like there's a contradiction or some kind of tension in the idea that he's saying what cannot be said.
Oh, yes. He has said a lot of things which cannot be said. And because of that, he says at the end that to treat his book also as nonsensical. In fact, the book which I have written, that also is situated on the other side of the boundary. So not it will not fall into the category of sensible. Or so in that way, Wittgenstein has really said a lot of things which cannot be said. So all those things which have been said in favor of his thesis is also something which cannot be said from the Tractarian perspective.
Yeah, so can you say a little bit then what silence means for Wittgenstein at the end of the Tractatus, and how silence is present in Tagore's work as well?
In fact, this is very important. Both of them regarded silence as very important. But this admonition to silence for both of them is for the scientists and the philosophers. Scientists and the philosophers alike, but not for the poets, not for the musician, not for the artists, not for the sculpturists, not for the dancers, because they have indirect ways to manifest something which cannot be stated, for which one should remain silent. Silent means silent in factual language. But these discourses, they in fact access the beyond in indirect manner. And so I believe that accessing the beyond is not paradoxical here, because one can access the beyond by bending its meaning, by being suggestive, by pointing to something which is not in the world.
And so this is the role of the aesthetic for both Wittgenstein and Tagore.
Yes.
And so then towards the end of the book, you talk about the play Raja in Tagore. You talk about the play Raja by Tagore and how it was compelling for Wittgenstein. Can you say a little bit about what Wittgenstein found compelling in the play, in your hypothesis? What's going on in this play that is so important, given what we've talked about?
It's regarding transformation. The play is about the transformation of the queen.
This is a queen a fictional queen in this play.
A fictional queen. And the king is someone whom no one can see, but can only feel. It's an allegorical play. Allegorical play, not stating of facts kind of play, and metaphorical as well. So the queen wants to see the king in broad daylight, but the king doesn't want to show her his appearance in broad daylight. He used to come in after dusk, and so they cannot. Queen had one maidservant called Shurangama. She can feel the king, but not the queen. The queen had, the king is someone whom you cannot even say that he is a benevolent king. No one, people hear about him, but no one has ever experienced the king. So the king, queen once wanted, she in fact forced the king to appear before him in broad daylight during a spring festival. Then the king warned whether she'll be able to recognize him, but she was confident. She said, "Yes, I will," but she could not. So she gave her garland to some other king, and some hell broke loose into her, and she had to go through sufferings. And later she had some kind of awakening within himself after so much suffering. And later she met her king. Well, beauty, the outside beauty did not matter to her that much. That it seems that Wittgenstein was, and it had an impact on Wittgenstein. It seems that this transformation was necessary. This transformation, that is, transformation in the boundary of the world, in the meaning of the world. Unhappy world can become happy only by transformation. So this transformation of the queen was important for Wittgenstein. And this concept of renunciation also, that you will have to be over those things which we ordinarily desire. We'll have to get ourselves to the level of something which is desirable. That which is desirable may be something which we usually do not desire. But once you have that change of mind, once you have that change, transformation in your life and the world, then you adore then you adore that thing which is usually not desirable, which may be ugly, but that does not matter. That becomes beautiful too. And another thing is that also reflects the philosophy of harmony, that truth, like beauty and ugliness, pleasure and pain, they are not in that way binary, in the sense they get harmonized in a different worldview, say it viewing from eternity.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of talk of anxiety and also despair in both Wittgenstein, but this is not inconsistent with the idea of harmony. So the idea of an anxiety about knowing God, or a despairing kind of worry about the state of the world, that is still consistent with this idea of harmony.
This is not inconsistent. Yes, this is not inconsistent, because accepting the agony, anxiety, despair of the moment, we can raise ourselves above these things.
Wonderful. So this has all been very illuminating in terms of understanding the ideas in Tagore and how they are, if not directly influential for Wittgenstein, because of course we can't know that, and you're not arguing that in your book, at least there's, like you're saying, this interesting convergence in the ideas of these two thinkers. So I appreciate you walking us through their ideas. In the time we have left, we're coming to time. Can you tell us what you're working on right now, since you have completed this book?
Yes, at present, I'm not working on Wittgenstein, though I have an intention to do it in future. At present, the last 2 years, I was within a project of Bengali philosophy of Bengali in 19th century. And I concentrated on Pandit Ishwar Chandra Vidyasagar. There are others: Bankimchandra Chattopadhyay, Akshay Kumar Dutta, Rabindranath, and other. But it was his bicentenary. He was born in 1820, and it's unbelievable the work he has done in his lifetime. And I was finding out on the secular humanism, which he wanted to inculcate in the society by bringing in reforms in education, reforms in social practices. He wanted to bring in, but there are objections, kind of thing that people think that these 19th century Bengali thinkers, they all are influenced by the logical positivists. Their wisdom is borrowed, their wisdom is not original, etc. But as I'm going through his own writings, his own library, I can see that he was really a man of philosopher and a social reformer, and which needs, we should explore him more. And I'm doing that at present.
For people who, like myself, cannot read in the original languages here in Bengali, how can we come to know about Bengali philosophers? Is there material that's been translated?
Yes. There are not much though. These days, some things are getting translated, and you can get English translation of Bankimchandra Chattopadhyay. At least his Dharma Tattva, like his view on religion. That is also a very interesting view on religion, which he wanted to advocate, but somehow it did not materialize. But the content is really interesting, very interesting.
Okay. Okay, so we should I should start taking a look and see what I can find in translation until such time as you and others can make it more available to those of us who unfortunately don't have as many languages under our belt. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you also. And I have seen your CV. You have done a lot in Indian philosophy.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. I very much appreciate your time.
Thank you.